This podcast of NPR's On Point with Tom Ashbrook is a production of WBUR Boston.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Home, said Robert Frost, is the place where, when you go there, they have to take you in. But if that home is a house, how will it make you feel once you're there? Cultural critic Winifred Gallagher has written a psychological tour of the American home, room by room. She calls it house thinking, but it's really about how houses make us feel and why, about how we shape houses and then they shape us for years, maybe for life. The alcove that enfolds the shaft of morning sun, the intimate and the public faces, from Edith Wharton's bedroom to McMansion land. Up next on Point, room by room, thinking about how our houses make us think and act and feel. We'll be joined later in the hour by House and Garden Editor-in-Chief Dominic Browning. But first, joining me from New York is Winifred Gallagher, author of the new book, House Thinking, a room-by-room look at how we live. Winifred Gallagher, thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
What a wonderful book. It's just terrific. You've taken such an intimate pulse of houses and how they affect us. We shape them, and then they shape us. I wish you'd just dive straight into the foyer, maybe, of your book, the first paragraph of the first chapter, to give us a sense of how you approach this, Winifred.
Sure. Some places just feel like home. As soon as you walk through the door, you want to stay. You want to curl up by the fireplace, throw a big party in the loft space, lounge on the old porch, or follow that staircase to wherever it goes. These special homes come in all sizes, shapes, and styles, from twee country cottages and grand pre-war apartments to rambling suburban ranch houses and small beach condos. What they have in common is a tonic effect on your behavior, how you think, feel, and act. One indication that you're in such a home is that you feel both interested and relaxed.
Interested and relaxed sounds like a great way to be in any home. Winifred Gallagher's book is House Thinking, a room-by-room look at how we live. I love the way you approach this. It's so, at least it felt to me, so far from the kind of glossy, you-must-have-this-look approach of the magazines. We'll hear from Dominic Browning on that front in a few minutes. But what is, describe for us the scale or the kind of beginning mindset that you brought, Winifred, to looking at homes, houses?
Well, this book is my fifth book, but it's actually a sequel to my first book, which was called The Power of Place. And that book looked at environmental behavioral research that reveals how different physical settings, different places affect our behavior. For that book, I went to Alaska to look at the effects of extreme environments. I did reporting in neonatal intensive care unit. I went all over looking at all different kinds of environments and how they affect us. And this book, House Thinking, is really that book, Power of Place, only it's just focused on the home. I went through each room in the home and looked at its history, talked to designers and architects, and also consulted the environmental behavioral research on the kinds of dynamics that happen in particular rooms and how the ways that we arrange those rooms, whether they support the behavior that goes on in the rooms or not.
Give us a whole house. Yeah.
The book is really it's an invitation for the reader to go around to each room in the home and kind of stand in the threshold of that room and say, what do I need this room to do for me, to be for me? How can this room make me feel, help me to feel and function at my very best? And that's quite a different question from the one we're much likelier to ask is, how does the room look? Does the furniture go together? Does it need a paint job? Is it as nice as Sally and Jeff's? These are very different questions that have a lot more to do with visuals. And what I'm asking people to do is to think about their homes in terms of behavior. Is your living room a welcoming place that says this is where friends and family gather to relate to each other? Or does it look like a showroom down at the Ethan Allen store that should have like a red velvet rope stretched across it? Or is it set up so that if the man from Mars came down and looked at your living room, would he think that it was a shrine set up to worship a giant flat screen television?
And these aren't just issues, they're not just issues of look, as you point out. You say this really goes to the sort of fundamentals of behavior within a family, people's social lives, how people feel about themselves and the people they live with.
Absolutely. Every room in our homes, and I stress, even though the book is called House Thinking, this refers equally to apartments or lofts. It's really any sort of a home. We have over American tradition and also evolutionary tradition developed certain spaces to serve certain behavioral needs. And sometimes that gets lost in the shuffle of trying to have homes that look really super.
You write about figures from American history and how their homes reflected living spaces, but also kind of models or molds for a way of living and being that they hoped to communicate. Share some of that with us.
Well, I guess I was terribly impressed with Thomas Jefferson. Of course, everybody knows that his beautiful home in Virginia, Monticello, was it's a triumph of architectural design. What really impressed me about Monticello, actually, though, was the fact that Jefferson lived in a private apartment that was completely separate from the rest of the house. He was arguably one of America's first apartment dwellers. He had lived in France, and France was one of the first, if not the first, countries to actually have residential apartments. And Jefferson came back and designed a wonderful behavior setting for himself. Even his grandchildren, he kept it locked. Even his grandchildren who lived there had to ask him for a key if they wanted to
enter. To the main house?
To knock at the door.
To the main house or the apartment?
To his apartment within the main house. It was really a suite, a ground floor suite that helped Jefferson be who he needed to be depending on what he was doing. He was clearly a great intuitive environmental psychologist. So he had his bedroom area. Adjacent to that was an area that he used for his scientific experiments and his correspondence. He was a very prolific letter writer. Then you moved from there into his what he called his book room. He had one of the largest private libraries in America, which later went to the Library of Congress. So when he was Jefferson the Scholar, he was in that room. He had a very practical side. He had a workbench where he enjoyed making locks and keys and simple objects like that. It must have been sort of relaxing for him. He was a fanatic gardener. He had a greenhouse. So he had within his wonderful house that also had spectacular public rooms that were equally sensitive in terms of manipulating behavior. He created this very private realm for himself.
And let me ask you, I mean,
really impressive.
Yeah, good for Thomas Jefferson. And yet everybody knows he died deep in debt and Monticello was part of the reason. Are you suggesting that to achieve this kind of simpatico environment, we all have to build from scratch personal sort of shrines to our personal endeavors and psychologies and sort of from the ground
up, not
a home that fits us?
I think that's really my point. He was a very particular kind of person. And the model here is not that we should do like Jefferson and build a mansion and a separate apartment inside it for us, but rather he knew who he was. He knew what he needed from his environment, and he set about creating it for himself. To take another president, a very different kind of president, let's say Bill Clinton, one of probably the most extroverted people on the planet right now.
Famously never owned a home other than the governor's mansion, which he lived in Arkansas in the White House.
I think he would have felt awful in Thomas Jefferson's apartment. He would have felt locked away from the action. He doesn't particularly want to spend a lot of time by himself. He would do very well in a modern house with a big great room where all the action is.
You talk a lot about the great room, and as particularly as it shows up in McMansions, as you and many others describe them today. How are we doing as Americans overall with our housing stock in achieving houses, homes that bring out the best in ourselves?
Well, it's not that McMansions or great rooms are good or bad. It's that it depends on who you are and what your needs are and whether they meet your needs. I think one real concern about America's housing stock is that the 2000 census shows that the sort of mom, dad, and the kids, that nuclear family is now barely half of the population, which means that almost half of the population now are non-traditional households. Single people, divorced people, gay couples, adult children living with elderly parents, all different kinds of constellations of households.
So?
Yet we're continuing to build houses that were based on the sort of 1950s Ozzie and Harriet nuclear family model. And not only are we building that same house, we're building it twice as big.
Winifred, I want to get into room by room, but you've got these great sort of big issues that you put out at the outset. And it's interesting. It's not about brick or stucco or this particular design or that, but very broad five characteristics you describe as critically important. Prospect and refuge, enticement, peril in a home, interesting, and complex order. I wish you'd take us through those.
Yes. Some of our greatest early modern architects, Frank Lloyd Wright and Bernard Maybeck, were real masters of prospect and refuge. And I should hasten to add that these five factors have been isolated by wonderful architect Grant Hildebrand out in the state of Washington. Prospect and refuge is really a wonderful thing to incorporate in any room. Frank Lloyd Wright was especially great at doing it in his living areas.
He called it nesting and perching.
Yes, he called it nesting and perching.
What did he mean?
He built in every house he did had a fireplace, also Maybeck. And Wright would lower the ceiling around the fireplace and create kind of almost a little cave within the living room in around the fireplace. So you could sit in that fireplace cave and feel refuge or nesting in his vocabulary. You could feel safe and sheltered from the world, even from the larger room. But you could enjoy, while sitting there, you could look out. Part of your pleasure was the fact that you could look out onto the prospect, the open living space where there might be other people chatting or having a snack or whatever. And that was the bigger picture. So depending on your mood, you could be out in that more extroverted, more open space or cuddled up by the fire.
You take this back almost to a caveman, cavewoman instincts. Taliesin.
Absolutely.
They're huddled by the fireplace or looking out on the big range where, I don't know,
absolutely,
the antelope may bound by.
It actually corresponds to lots of research in different cultures where if you show people different landscapes, big majorities of them pick as their favorite an open field with a grove of trees and maybe like a winding road. Mm-hmm. It's so that you can hide in the grove of trees or feel sheltered or get shade from the sun and look out on the field where you're likely to see game. For example, if you're talking about back in our hunting and gathering days, there seems to be something about this combination of the sheltered refuge and the big open prospect that's innately appealing to us. And we can employ it indoors as well as outdoors.
Then you've got enticement and peril. Interesting combination.
There again, enticement is that winding road through the landscape. There's something very seductive if you take a walk out in the country, if you're on a dirt road, as I do often up near my place upstate. Mm-hmm. There's a particular patch of dirt road that goes up and down rather sharply and winds through trees with fields on each side that is absolutely my favorite place to walk.
And what does that mean in a house?
It's enticing you in a house. It could be the way the circulation space, the circulation areas, the hallways, and the ways that you get from one place to another in the house. Is it like a boring straight run where you can see every part of the house from the front door? Or does it have this quality of enticement where you wonder, gee, what's around that bend? What's behind that low bookcase? It's adding interest, the same sorts of things that make us want to explore landscape outside.
Peril hardly sounds like something we normally associate with a comfy home. But you've
it
got it here as a key factor.
And it's actually, peril is one of the things that we're the likeliest to pay big money for, either in rental or the cost of a house, to incorporate some peril in our homes. Peril is the idea of, like, say, being up on a high mountain and looking down and feeling dizzy. That's peril. But if you change that to a penthouse apartment in a city that gives you a great view of the water or of Central Park.
Or the Hollywood Hills.
That's managing peril. So all of a sudden, what would be perilous if you were out in an unprotected situation is thrilling. We similarly pay more for houses that have balconies and porches and places that we can have a special view that could be dangerous but isn't.
And complex order. Order, but not too orderly.
That's right. And this is one of the big... Our species excels in taking in information and sorting it. That's one of the things we're not so great at flying or smelling, but we're really great at processing information. So we really, our brains are engaged when we're in a situation where we can sort of take in the big picture and also categorize it. This is why older suburbs, pre-war suburbs, are so much more sought after and so much more expensive than new McMansion communities, because these older suburbs were developed a couple houses at a time by different developers, different buildings, and they have there is an orderly scheme, but there's enough difference so that we find them more interesting, whereas something that's very uniform or has like three or four different uniform shapes that's just stamped out all over the subdivision is monotonous.
So give us just a little bit of a puzzle, enough variety to keep us guessing, keep our big old evolutionary brain working on the environments around us. Jeff is calling from Fort Drum, New York. Hi, Jeff. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you today?
Very well. What do you know, Jeff?
Well, I'd like to comment on the evolution of my parents' home, actually.
Okay.
For years, the focal point had always been the living room, as well as a room where they had a wood stove that we could see the fire, sort of that cozy cave-like environment that you had spoke to earlier.
Mm-hmm.
Their kitchen was always very small, kind of crowded, maybe one or two people in there at a time. But then they got their kitchen remodeled, and all of a sudden the family started to move into the kitchen more, because everyone could be there at once.
And how did that affect the family dynamic, or did it, Jeff?
It actually did affect it quite a bit, because now instead of us interacting with the TV or sitting around the cave, we're now engaged in conversation, we're cooking family meals together. And one thing that has done for my wife and I is that now, as we're looking to get out of the military and we look at purchasing a house or building a house, our main focus is the kitchen.
Jeff, stick with us for a second. Winifred, I'd love to hear your response. You note in the book that that's been a huge focus in this country over the last decade and more. You've got mixed feelings about the giant kitchen.
Well, here again, it's not a matter of whether it's good or bad. It's a matter of whether it's right for you. The kitchen is a very important part of the new American home. It's the commonest renovation in America. The average kitchen reno costs $45,000, and many, many cost much more. What is fascinating, it sounds like caller's family, it's working out wonderfully, because that's a space where they are actually socializing and using, and they're cooking, and it's like the heart of the home. And I think that's absolutely super. What I also question, though, interestingly, there are fewer and fewer families like Jeff's. We are actually cooking less and less and less. We are eating together as families less and less and less. And yet our kitchens are getting bigger, bigger, and bigger.
So you've got $100,000 kitchens that only the microwave is used.
Right? Oh, yeah, you just microwave the takeout. So it's not good or bad. It's a matter of think about who you are and how much you actually cook and how much you actually eat at home, and then make a decision about how your kitchen should be. Don't just build a gigantic $100,000 kitchen because the people next door have one. I just heard about someone who just did that. A friend told me the other day about a neighbor who did this fabulous kitchen renovation, and then 3 or 4 years later sold the house and moved, and the new owners found that inside the stove, the Jillion-dollar Viking oven, were still all the papers and packing materials
the warranty
that had come with with the stove.
Jeff, it sounds like, Jeff, your family, you're looking forward to diving into a big kitchen and really using it.
It is. And we actually were a family of cooks, as it is. My dad taught me to cook. My mom taught me to cook. My wife cooks. So it's really kind of the focus of our family.
Terrific.
It makes perfect sense for the kitchen to be the heart of your home. Absolutely.
I hope you find just what you want and fire up that oven long before you leave it. Nima's calling from Boston. Hi, Nima. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm actually
actually a designer here in Boston. And
what kind of designer, Nima?
Architectural design. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We're located in Boston, and I do a lot of residential work. And, you know, we're talking about these McMansions and these new suburbs that are developing around America. And when you, I'd like to compare it to automotive industry in the sense that, you know, bigger isn't necessarily better. You know, you see these gas guzzlers on the road, and the trend is starting to shift back towards smaller cars that are more energy efficient. And I think you can compare that with architecture in the sense that, you know, we are going to be running out of energy or short on very soon. And why not design very thoughtful homes that are comfortable, but they don't have to be these McMansions.
So not Hummer-sized homes, you're saying.
Exactly. And I think there is a there could be a comparison between the two.
As a designer, when you approach architectural design with a big suburban home of the kind you're describing, is it difficult for you, Nima, or do you welcome the challenge?
Well, you know, I think practicing around Boston, a lot of the homes are older, so they're not these McMansions necessarily. However, the trend has been to, you know, people generally the first thing they want is to open up the space as much as possible, you know, which sometimes causes some structural issues. But at the same time, you know, I try to advise them that, you know, everything being open necessarily isn't the best thing. You know, sometimes
That's
you do
right.
want to create surprise in spaces. You want to come into a foyer.
Mm-hmm.
Then you want to surprise the visitor in where the living room is or allow for certain views that you wouldn't expect necessarily, as opposed to having this gigantic open space like that, you know, as soon as you walk into a space, you've lost everything.
You see the whole thing. Winifred, that open space has been a great object or space of desire in recent years.
I think our love of this space, and a lot of them, they look fantastic, really started back in the 60s and 70s when artists started renovating industrial lofts. And then it became cool to have a loft, and it sort of migrated into apartments that were very loft-like and loft-like great rooms. The spaces do look good. And before I moved to my present house, I lived in a loft with kids. And it was essentially a giant great room. But what we had to do so that we could hear ourselves think, and what a lot of loft dwellers end up doing, is you essentially turn the loft into an apartment. You create bedrooms and offices and spaces because, it's very, very difficult for a number of people to share one big space. If one person is talking on the telephone or watching television or playing music, everybody has to listen. If one person is frying onions in the kitchen, everybody's got to smell those onions.
And yet that was the way it was, you point out, in history for a long time until the Victorians buttoned us up into much smaller rooms that Americans have broken out of more recently.
Well, a little before Victorians, actually, it's not that we have to do like the Victorians, who had extremely segmented little rooms for all different kinds of purposes. I think you can do a combination of we do in general in society. We're a much more casual society, and we often do want to integrate our living room and our dining room, or maybe even include the kitchen. But there are ways to do that without making most of the house a giant empty space that is very difficult for different people to share. You can some of the most thoughtful great rooms I've seen actually have had little alcoves and L's and even little additions with sliding glass doors, so you can have acoustical privacy. There are ways to do it that are more thoughtful and more interesting.
So make it more than a big amphitheater. Nima, thanks very much for your call. Winifred Gallagher, I wish you'd begin to take us through. You've got sort of great nuggets, sort of room by room, and you start right at the foyer here. Dive in with us. What do you look for there?
The entry is so important. The entry to your home literally frames the experience that you and your guests are going to have when you step in the door. Your entry should be saying welcome, but what it often says is watch out. It's often a dumping ground where you enter the home and you see a big pile of recycled newspapers and plastic bottles and
soccer shoes and umbrellas
and piles of coats because the kids won't hang up their coats. And it's a very disturbing rather than a calming. Your entrance should be saying you've now left the mad world behind and you're entering this wonderful refuge. And instead, it's like you're entering kind of the dumping ground. So cleaning it up, making it look welcoming, setting, doing something in your entrance, and it could be something as simple as a vase of flowers or a little table with some books if you're a bookish home.
A musical instrument, you say.
That's yes, one of the best and completely free renovations that we did in our house in the course of writing the book. We moved our beat-up old piano into the entrance hall, which is a big enough space.
Yeah.
So that when our guests and when we ourselves open the door, the first thing we see is a piano, which says subtly, this is a home where people value music and the arts. This is a home where people like to have a good time.
Yeah.
It just is a subtle signal about what you might expect when you proceed further. And it also was a very, and this is a thing that I really urge people to think about, making more different uses of the spaces we have. A lot of us do not live in, especially if we live in cities and apartments, we need to really use our spaces thoughtfully for more things than we do. So this piano in a conventional setting would have been upstairs in the living room, taking up a lot of space in the living room, and meaning that when the kids were playing the piano, no one could be in the living room.
Right.
So by simply moving it to the entry, we're getting a lot more use out of our entry and our living room.
We've got just a half minute before the break, but the living room, you say, is the place to get even much more personal in your view.
The living room is really expression central. It's the place where you show you, yourself, and your family and your friends who you are and what's important to you. So don't make that room about the television unless that is the most important thing to you. If you've got to put your television in your living room, put it down low on a low table, off to one side, and don't arrange the whole room around the television.
I love, Winifred, you quote the architect Jeremiah Eck here talking about homes as this. They come out of a spiritual investment. He says a classic colonial in the middle of the frontier speaks of the Declaration of Independence. Shingle-style house reflects the characteristics of confidence and exuberance that Americans celebrated in the late 19th century. We love these domestic icons because of their metaphysical qualities, and you're taking us right to them. We're joined as well now from New York by Dominic Browning, editor-in-chief of House and Garden magazine, author of Around the House and in the Garden and Paths of Desire. Dominic Browning, thanks for being with us.
Hi there. Thank you for having me.
So you tucked into Winifred's book and came out enjoying it a lot, even though she sort of takes a swipe at the business you're part of, the home magazine world. What caught your attention here, Dominique?
Well, that's okay. I don't mind a swipe. I think the book is wonderful. And, of course, what's one of the great things about it is that it's such an intelligent look at a subject we care so passionately about.
Care about in every detail, and yet a lot of people don't end up feeling as they'd like to feel in their home. Do you think Winifred's on to some of the reasons why here?
Oh, I think that's absolutely true. A lot of people feel uncomfortable or unhappy. They don't think through how they want to live in their rooms or why they want to use a certain color, why they want to use a certain piece of furniture. And I think the argument for being very mindful about how you're decorating is an important argument.
And what about the argument Winifred makes that she says most of our information about the home comes from profit-driven experts, media and merchants who insist that how our houses and apartments look is more important than the less commercial but crucial issue of how they make us feel. Are we driven by, you must buy this and that expert?
No, I think that's really just silly because, of course, the people who want you to buy their things want you to feel good about them. So there's not really a conflict there. I think that really what we're talking about is people not getting to the bottom of why they feel about a certain thing. And it has nothing to do with whether somebody's trying to sell you something.
Winifred, what about it? Dominic Browning writes that the difference between look and feel is so small you can barely distinguish. You look at something and you feel something immediately.
I think that that's very true if you're talking about someone like Dominique or a very talented interior designer or interior decorator or architect. I have no quarrel with those professions at all. They do wonderful work. What I'm talking about really is the fact that most, by a huge majority, most Americans never get a chance to work with an architect or a talented design professional, and they have to kind of feel it on their own and figure out what to do on their own. And I think very often the fallback position is go to Ethan Allen or go to IKEA and buy the whole set without really thinking about what's right for them. Sometimes I watch these cable shows and I'm fascinated by the ones where they have a whole team of complete strangers come in and ransack your home.
Right, right.
And it's like the old joke about wearing your clothes inside out. They sort of turn everything upside down and paint everything, you know, shocking pink.
There, and I'll be happy.
The next door neighbors come in and do it. To me, this is like I would feel mugged. How could someone possibly and you know, the message they're trying to send to people is, you know, if you just get a glue gun and enough shocking pink paint, you'll be much happier. It's just nonsense.
Well, I think that is really, that's silly too. And I think the questions that you write about are the right way to do it. Anybody can analyze their own rooms if they learn how to think about it, which is what your book is about, which is, I think what the wonderful side of your book. The other side of what's happening in the world today that is also pretty great is that you can go to places like Target or Crate and Barrel or Pottery Barn or Ethan Allen and find great design. Nobody can tell you what you should buy for yourself, but for the first time in a really long time, great design is available at so many price points that you can't really say anymore, well, you know, I have to look frumpy because I can't afford anything else. It's just not the case anymore. But you're absolutely right. Nobody can come in and tell you this is how you should live.
Dominic Browning, you've got a pretty big view of how things go on here. Winifred Gallagher writes about the ebb and flow through history of how Americans understand their homes and when they've been more or less sort of in sync with human rhythms and supportive of a kind of blossoming of the fullness of life. How do you think we're doing these days on that front?
I think we're doing a lot better. Back to what I was talking about with Target, Ethan Allen, Crate and Barrel. Literally 20 years ago, you could be sitting in a small town in the middle of the country somewhere, and it would be very, very difficult to get your hands on items that were really well designed. If you had money, you could go to a big urban center or hire decorators to do it for you.
Mm-hmm.
But now, I think there is a sensitivity to great design at all levels and at all prices. I think the missing point, I don't know if it's missing, but I think the point that Winifred talks about in the book is for people now to become increasingly sensitive about what they want their rooms to do. And I think that has to do with a lot of how the country's changed, too. We don't feel like a kitchen has to be used only for cooking or a living room can only be used for a formal occasion. I think the rules are breaking down. And in place of that, we do need to be very careful about, okay, well, what are we going to use it for? What mood do we want there? How creative can we get about what we want to do in that room? And I think that's, to me, that's the heart of Winifred's book and the most compelling message in it.
So really living, and with design available much more widely now, good design. Dominic Browning, editor-in-chief at House and Garden, thanks very much for spending a few minutes with us.
You're so welcome, and congratulations, Winifred.
Thank you.
Let's turn to our callers. Shelley's calling from Atlanta, Georgia. Hi, Shelley. You're on the air.
Hello. We recently built a second home in the Seagrove Beach seaside area in Florida.
Uh-huh.
And it's a wonderful house, but it just has flat walls. And I'm wondering, how do you add, the nooks and crannies and the three-dimensional interest that draws you in and lets you display things to a house like that?
It's a great question. Winifred, you write that right across this country, in much of the 20th century, that's the kind of house that was built. So here's Shelley. She wants to know how to follow your guidance with it.
Yeah, and it's actually, I'm thrilled that you're thinking in those terms rather than thinking as is often the case of, like, automatically, let's add a lot of square footage, let's put on addition, you can make your home much more interesting and functional often by adding some bay windows or L's or small areas of interest. And I think, on the other hand, I do think this is one of those areas where it really, really, really makes sense for you to consult a good architect.
But are you saying she has to address it structurally?
$1 million.
She has to break out walls and put in new L's? She can't live
well,
with
if she wants to. If she wants to change, if she wants to, I think that if for no other reason than getting advice on window placement, it's really a great idea if you can possibly hire an architect and get a consultation. Architects are willing to, they know that not everybody has $1 million to spend. You can get consultations. You could get preliminary sketches that you can show to a contractor. I really think for that kind of a, it sounds like the caller has like a kind of a sophisticated mm-hmm. idea about space, and it really would serve her well to consult a design professional about that.
Shelley, it sounds like the advice there is to bust out a couple of walls, perhaps. Winifred Gallagher, it's interesting. You say that when it comes to that second home, which a lot of people we read about are lucky enough to have these days, a shack is as good as a mansion. What do you mean by that?
The overwhelmingly positive effect that you get from a second home is novelty. It, just the sheer fact that it's different from your first home really buys you a lot. So most of us live in an urbanized metropolitan area. Most of our second homes are in places with greater proximity to nature. So simply moving from an urban area to a rural or coastal area in itself is an enormous benefit that refreshes your senses, allows you to look at life from a different perspective. So it's not always necessary to spend a fortune to get a second home that really works well for you.
Shack as good as a mansion. Luke is calling from Boston. Hi, Luke. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I'm a landscape architect, and there's a long tradition in landscape history known as the sublime, where a landscape was designed to activate your senses subtly or sometimes not so. You know, as an example, a path that might come out of the woods and mm-hmm. and end in a cliff. I was interested in the comment earlier about a controlled fear or danger, such as an apartment balcony, you know, high above the street. And this is the first time that I've heard the sublime applied to architecture. And I'm just wondering, is it also a tradition in architectural history?
Definitely. The Gothic Cathedral, the impact of the Gothic Cathedral was very much the same impact that you would get in the Grand Canyon. It's called, in environmental psychology, it's called the diminutive effect. It's anytime you're in a place that really puts you at a whole different scale, that makes you feel like, wow, you know, as you do if you're looking up in a Gothic cathedral or a great sublime, you know, a river landscape like a Thomas Cole painting that you're talking about. Anytime that you're in that kind of a setting, it reinforces that you're just part of a big picture. For some people, this is a spiritual experience. For some, it's a philosophical experience. But this is one of the great benefits that we get when we go to a natural environment. You're staring up at a mountain, and it makes you think differently about yourself, or a great waterfall. And you definitely can do this in the home environment with different balconies, winding staircases, roof decks, anything that plunges you into a different sense of your own scale and where you sit in the great scheme of things.
It sounds as though Luke is also responding to your prospect and refuge or to those that you cite, this sort of flow that landscape architects look for of security and then opening up the same kind of flow you're describing here in homes. We should look at a couple more rooms for us, maybe the bedroom and the bathroom. I found you interesting on each. What do you have to say there, Winifred?
The bedroom was one of the most surprising rooms in terms of the research I did. The bedroom should be a private sanctuary for you. It's really your home within your home, so it's the place where you can retreat to when even the larger home might be too much for you. And it's also the place where most people have most of their intimate relations. Interestingly, even though we're supposed to have a sex-obsessed culture, there's almost nothing in the historical research about the bedroom as a setting for sexual activity, except for some Victorian doctors who admonished husbands whose wives were pregnant that the husband should sleep in a separate room.
So what makes a bedroom good on that front?
And that you shouldn't put a baby in bed with you because you could kill the baby. In other words, the historical information is all negative in a way. And all the architects I talked to, they would be slack-jawed when I'd ask, do any of your clients ever say that they'd like to have the bedroom be a positive setting for sex?
A sexy bedroom?
No,
how do you?
They're stupefied by it. I think, now, what does it mean to have a sexy bedroom? Does that mean it has to look like a bordello or have a mirror on the ceiling? No. It should be, first of all, serene. whether this is just for you or for you as a couple, the bedroom should not be like a big closet that's covered with piles of debris and a television set and an exercise machine.
Stacks
those
of bills.
Those things do not belong in your bedroom. The bedroom, the romantic bedroom, should be private. You should have a lock on the door if you're in a family setting. A wonderful little and often inexpensive renovation for a bedroom is to punch a doorway into an adjacent bathroom if your bedroom does not open directly onto a bathroom. That's a wonderful amenity that means you're not taking that trip down the hallway in your towel with the kids looking on. Acoustical privacy is wonderful. Acoustical privacy in Europe is orders of magnitude greater than it is here. If you're renovating, it's definitely worth making sure your rooms are soundproof.
And once you're in that bathroom, you say, what's it going to be, a private sanctuary or neurosis central? What do you mean?
Yes. It's not an accident that the incidence of bulimia and anorexia nervosa and body dysmorphic disorder, which means feeling ugly for no good reason, these things have climbed along with the proliferation of equipment we have to inspect ourselves. Until the Victorian era, most people did not have mirrors. If you didn't have a mirror, it's pretty difficult to obsess about how you look all the time. But until after World War II, people did not have scales in their bathrooms. Getting weighed was something that happened once in a while. Maybe you went to a doctor's office or something like that.
Throw out the mirrors and the scale and put a grass mat floor.
It should be a private sanctuary. I think a nice thing to do with the bathroom, which we don't often think of, it's really a great place to incorporate nature. Water is nature. And anything you can do in your bathroom that sort of plays up the appeal of water, the sound of it, the look of it. I like to keep plants in my bathroom. There's certain plants that do really well in the bathroom. Make it a place that makes you feel good about yourself, not a place where you walk in and the first thing you see is like a doctor scale and you think, oh, my God, I've gained 4 ounces.
Winifred, we just got half a minute here. What does this mean? A complete makeover, huge renovation, or touches?
Absolutely not. A psychological renovation is a matter of going to each room and asking yourself what you want this room to do for you. It often, we spent maybe $500 on a 5-story house in the course of renovating it, and our house looks completely differently. It's maybe you have to move your furniture around. Maybe you have to take some things from upstairs downstairs. Maybe you have to get rid of a lot of clutter. Maybe you have to highlight things that are about you, that are personal rather than generic. It's really a matter of, much more a matter of thinking than about effort or expense.
Winifred Gallagher, it's been wonderful talking with you. Thanks so much for your view of the American home. Winifred Gallagher's new book is House Thinking, a room-by-room look at how we live. You can continue this conversation or download the On Point podcast and subscribe to our daily newsletter, all at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.